Welcome, everybody, to a very special edition of Podcasting Them Softly. We're incredibly proud to be joined by veteran film producer Evzin Kolar, whose credits include Street Smart, the epic canon films Masters of the Universe, Double Impact, Surf Ninjas, and a film that was made to be featured as a film of the week on Podcasting Them Softly, the 1997 hard-nosed neo-noir City of Industry. Evzin also produced the soundtrack, which is a must-own for any cinephile soundtrack junkie. Before becoming a producer, Evzin worked as an assistant director, a unit manager on Never Say Never Again, and he has also done some stunt work. Welcome to the show, sir. Nick and I cannot wait to dig into anything and everything about City of Industry.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming on the show. Your credits are amazing. They stretch multiple genres. And when you look at them, I really realize these movies I used to watch when I was younger, especially of Masters of the Universe. So I'll certainly I still have vivid memories of my mother taking me and my buddy to see it at the movie theater. And she watched it with us, too. So I got to give her a lot of credit for that, because that's not mom material, maybe. But this will be a lot of fun. Can't wait.
That's great, because it's funny, I don't know what age you are, but I remember when we were shooting Masters of the Universe, my son at the time must have been, I think, 8 years old, and he used to go, He-Man, and he was raising the sword and get the photographs with Dolph Lundgren, and it was a lot of fun.
Listen, He-Man was the end-all, be-all, pinnacle of existence for me. I was 7 years old when I saw that movie in the theater, or six and a half, seven. So it was basically the greatest movie I had ever seen in my entire 6 or 7 years of existence on the planet Earth. And since then, I have watched it countless times. Every time I watch it, it's more entertaining than the last. I still think that Frank Langella's performance in that movie is just a tour de force. It's absolutely incredible. And if Frank and I had said a year ago that we were going to do a podcast, I don't know if I'd ever be able to say that I was going to speak to somebody who produced Masters of the Universe. So this is like, let alone...
Too kind, but you're right. Frank Langella was amazing as a Skeletor. He was amazing with the mask, and he is such an imposing figure because, you know, he's very tall. He's like 6'3" at least, you know. And so he was amazing. I agree with you. He's basically amazing in any film.
Oh, yeah. And Courtney Cox, like my first crush in a movie, like I was totally in love with her. And like, it's such a blast. Like, it's such a fun movie even now. And like you had, and also like, you know, it was when I had become obsessed with Back to the Future. So you have James Tolkien is in there. And like, I just remembered him, you know, as Strickland. So it's just such a great movie to watch nowadays. Like, I know that it has this reputation, you know, like the whole thing, but I don't care. Like, it's such a fun movie. A kid's movie nowadays could never, ever, ever retain that sort of sense of fun or, you know, movie magic. So I don't care what they can do all that what they want with CGI, but we'll never have another Masters of the Universe.
Yeah, it was tough because we went like $3 million over budget on the visual effects. When I say visual effects on effects, because those days there was no CGI, so everything was done either real stuff or miniatures and blue screen. You know, so it was amazing experience.
Yeah, I was a little late to the game with Masters of the Universe. I'm a bit younger. I'm 30, so I kind of missed the He-Man train when I was growing up. It was all Star Wars and G.I. Joe for me. But Masters of the Universe came into my life when I became obsessed with Dolph Lundgren. And I know Nick has heard me say this a million times, but I like to consider my film collection very highbrow. And then I have every Dolph Lundgren Blu-ray that I can find. And I have the Canon Films box set on DVD that came out this year that had Masters of the Universe. I had seen it prior. I saw it when I was in college.
Frank actually bought that for me. He got that for me as a gift. So
yes, the Canon Films set.
Yeah, he'll never live that down. It's great.
No,
I tell you,
perfect.
Honestly, Canon Films era when they were on the top of the game, it was unbelievable. And I must say I loved that time because dealing with Menachem, was at least you get immediately an answer whether your film is go or not go. You know, you don't go through committees, etc. You just say, we're going to do it or we can't do it. You know, and that was it. And it was great. And as I said, my first big budget film I produced was with Cannon, with Morgan Freeman and Christopher Reeve, and Morgan got an Oscar nomination.
Street Street Smart. Street Smart was, again, you know, I'm 35, so my father, turning 36, my father was very eager to show me Richard Donner's Superman. Is one of the first movies that I have a memory of seeing, you know, on TV or anything. And I remember that Street Smart was a movie that I saw on HBO or one of the movie Showtime down in the basement when I should have been doing, you know, watching Sesame Street or something. But it was the movie that had Superman in it, but it wasn't Superman. So that movie always had this like distinct, I have a distinct memory of Street Smart, and I would love to say that I've seen it recently and I haven't, and I really need to. I would love to revisit it.
It's a very good movie, and it was great experience for me because, you know, Jerry Schatzberg, who obviously is well known New Yorker, and he was every producer feared him, and I was young, naive producer, and I basically produced the film as I felt from the guts and from what I believe, and Jerry Schatzberg loved it, and I had the greatest time on that film with him. And it was actually me and Jerry who fought to hire Morgan Freeman because Menachem didn't want him.
Interesting. Not wanting Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, because don't forget, Morgan Freeman at the time was a fairly well-known theater actor, and I think he just did one film, which was Brubaker, the prison movie.
Yeah. When did he do Lean On
Me? Nothing really else. No, it was no. Lean On Me was later.
Yeah.
He did actually, before even Lean On Me, after our film Street Smart, he did film for my friend Bruce Beresford, which was Driving Miss Daisy, because Bruce actually asked me to see the film before he cast him in it.
When you had it, now had you been a fan of Superman when before working with Christopher Reeve? Like, what was that like?
I wasn't. And what actually happened is that the project was actually Christopher Reeve's pet project, and I remember. At the time, I was already working with the Canon group, and Menachem wanted to do, and I think he did, Superman, one of the three or four or whatever number it was. And Christopher Reeve said, I'll do it, but you have to finance my film, which is called Street Smart. That's how actually the film got financed. And because Menachem gave us X number of dollars to do the film, so we knew that we cannot afford to shoot it in New York, so we were scouting location with Jerry Schatzberg. We went actually to Pittsburgh, and then at the end we decided on Montreal, because Montreal from exteriors, etc., which we dressed up and interior, we shot 80% of the film in Montreal.
Yeah, the Golan Globus years, really the Canon years, like they really did inform my childhood as watching, like as a budding movie lover. I mean, it's amazing when you look back and you think about all of the stuff that they put out and just the variety of stuff. I mean, obviously some of it better than others, most of it just really fun, and then some amazing gems that are sort of strewn about throughout the whole filmography. I really can't imagine my cinematic upbringing without those guys.
Oh, listen, they were, and you have to give them credit and a chutzpah, because I don't know if you knew, my wife's father was the actor Robert Shaw, and he was at one long time at the kind of beginning of his career. They hired him, the Golan Globus boys, in Israel to do this film called Diamonds, where he was playing double role. You got to see it. If you have not seen Diamonds, you have to see it, because you're going to piss yourself laughing. Because he played two parts. One, a straight guy, bad guy, and one gay guy. That was Robert Shaw playing those two parts. But the funniest thing was that the way they were able to make that film for the money and pay the actors a lot of money, but rest for equipment and for crew, not very much money, is because, as you know, you have a 2-day rental on equipment, right? So when commercial companies rent equipment, they shoot 2 or 3 days, and then the rest of the 4 days, things lie around. So Menachem paid them a little bit money and used their equipment before they returned it. So every week they had a different equipment, different drivers, different things. It was absolutely nightmare. And it was again, what I'm saying is that you have to see the film because it's one of the funniest bad film I have ever seen.
The poster is absolutely amazing. They even bill Robert Shaw as Robert Jaws Shaw on the poster. I've never seen such a thing.
Oh, did you see that poster? I didn't see that poster because obviously there was after they re-released it, because I believe Diamonds was done way before Jaws.
Yeah, no, this poster here is just, I'll send it to you. This is one of the greatest posters I think maybe I've ever seen. And Frank and I are huge fans of posters from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. This has to be seen. I mean, I can't believe this. It says Robert Jaws Shaw Richard Shaft Roundtree. I can't. It's unreal.
Oh my God. I can't. You go to, if you have a time, take a picture and send it to me. I want to show it to my wife.
We will. I can't believe that your father-in-law is Robert Shaw.
Yeah. He was an interesting character, definitely.
Yeah, I would say so. was that at all intimidating, having him in your family?
You know what? Not really, because I don't know what it was, because coming from Eastern Europe, I was born in Prague, and I really emigrated when I was 19 years old. And so when I came to England and I met my future wife, it was 1974, I believe. When was Jaws released, actually, in Europe? 74 or 75?
I would have to look that up.
Doesn't matter, but it was exactly the same year. It was the same year I met my wife and the Jaws was released in a theaters in London. I was living there and doing theater. And so it was funny, in December I saw the film, and then in July I traveled with my future wife to Ireland where he was living, and to be introduced. And funny enough, it wasn't really intimidating, because I guess I was young and cocky or whatever, and sure, I was impressed. But what was wonderful about him is that he loved sports and he loved challenging people. He loved to bet. And so he immediately, before even I opened a suitcase, I had to play tennis game with him. And of course I beat him, because I was quite good as a young man at the tennis. And so he was very impressed and he became very friendly.
That's absolutely unbelievable.
I can't get over this. This is amazing.
This is not where I expected the conversation to go.
No, not at all. This completely, my next question is completely underwhelming now. I know we want to dig into City of Industry, but I want to ask you, you worked on Never Say Never Again. Now, I am a diehard James Bond fan, hardcore. I've owned every movie from VHS to Blu-ray, and I have never quite come to accept Never Say Never Again in the quote-unquote Bond canon. I was wondering how you feel about that.
Well, I don't know how to honestly answer. It's I always thought, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, you're probably going to agree too, that Sean Connery was the best Bond, and ever, I think. It was in London while I was doing theater, and my wife was working on Empire Strikes Back. She was executive assistant to George Lucas and Irving Kershner. I met Irving Kershner, And he liked me, and I started to work with him reading his script. And so basically when we then came to U.S., we immigrated to U.S., my wife and I. Kirsch, you know, we stay in touch. I was still kind of so-called developing stuff, helping him developing stuff. And then he was hired to do Bond film, and he knew that I grew up in France and I spoke fluent French, etc., and he liked my photography. He said, I'm going to do this. Why don't you go off and scout some location and see what happens, etc.? And so off I went, and next thing I know, I spent on it 7 months and setting up all the location in Spain, France, and Bahamas. And that's how I met, which I think was one of the most genuine and most beautiful person in this business, is Mickey Moore, who was the well-known second unit director. And that's where I learned really how to set up action, how to storyboarding and all that stuff. It was amazing experience. That's how I became, basically, because working from early start with Mickey Moore, setting it all up, all the action unit and everything regarding action, that I end up basically being the manager of the second unit, line producer of the second unit.
So your wife worked on Empire Strikes Back, huh?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, because if there's one thing I love in life more than anything, it's Star Wars. So this conversation is just making my brain explode in all sorts of different directions.
I'm sure she'll be happy to talk to you about it.
I would walk through fire for that conversation.
I'll watch it, how you walk through the fire.
Anybody can watch it. I will walk through fire and talk about Empire Strikes Back with your wife. But back to the original point. I've watched it more recently because I've gotten to know a lot of people through our podcast and online that are big Bond people, and a lot of them tell me to revisit Never Say Never Again, which I hadn't for a very long time. And upon my revisit a couple of times in the past year, I have actually grown to like it, even though it's not quote-unquote a Bond film. Because what? I think that came out when Octopussy was coming out. I think those two went head-to-head. I can't remember the more timeline that coincides with Never Say Never Again. But, I mean, Max von Sydow plays Blofeld, and I think that's one of the greatest things ever, because Max von Sydow is just a legend, and
right.
Blofeld's probably the greatest, one of the greatest cinematic villains of all time.
But, you see, the problem coming back to Empire Strikes, Never Say Never Again, is the following. Number one, Jack Schwartzman, who was the producer of the film, never really was able to come to the set because he was going around the world being sued by Cabri Broccoli, okay? So we had several line producers, etc. Number two, as much as I like Kirshner and rest in peace, Kirsch, Kirsch had one huge fault. And as you maybe know, there was a There was a saying in Hollywood, Kirshner is the only director who is able to put a greenlit project into development. What that means that Kirshner has to constantly dig with a screenplay and never be satisfied and always changing things. So what happened is that, for example, Mickey Moore and I were already in southern France, based in Monte Carlo, and suddenly Kirsch decided that he has to go and meet Sean Connery in Marbella and the first assistant director, and they have to rewrite the screenplay. So here we are sitting 2 months preparing all the shoot, and then it was constantly happening during the shoot. What I'm trying to say is that Kirsch is a great director when you basically give him the script is locked, he has to sign off on it and shoot the script he has. Because he had a great instinct with casting, because, you know, Klaus Maria Brandau as the bad guy was one of the best. And so on and so forth. You know, and he's very good with performances. As we know, Empire Strikes Back is probably the best acted of all the Star Wars movies, you know. So he had all these great attributes, but the worst is he can't make a decision. And that's what happened in later years when I was producing Desert Heat or Inferno with Jean-Claude Van Damme. The original director was Irving Kirshner, but I had to fire him during the pre-production because out of $20 million movie, he was suddenly making $40 million movie, changing script constantly. So that's why I think coming back to Never Say Never Again, that was the problem. If you look at it, the script didn't have a proper flow. It of course he had to stay truthful to the original. What was it called? A remake they had to make.
Thunderball,
exactly. But it really didn't have that proper flow, the script, because there were too many screenwriters, and as I said, Kirshner was constantly changing his mind.
That's just a fascinating story of Never Say Never Again, because I never thought we'd ever talk to anybody with any involvement to that, and that's amazing. And you're right, I've always loved Kirshner. I mean, obviously, I think Empire Strikes Back is one of the best movies ever made, and it's the best Star Wars film. But I've always very much thought his career was very interesting. How he kind of came in and he did RoboCop 2, Never Say Never Again. He had a very interesting filmography.
I think he was one of those directors, which there are a few of them, who is his own worst enemy, you know. And I'm saying it's with the fondness because, you know, Kirshner was a very old family friend from my wife's side because, you know, one of his very early films, if you have never seen it, you should, was Robert Shaw with his second wife, Mary Ure, called The Luck of Ginger Coffee, which was shot in Canada on a, like, shoestring budget, black and white, and it was about this Irish man emigrating with his wife to Canada to make it, and he doesn't make it at the end, but it's absolutely brilliant film. And since then, basically, the families stayed friends.
I'm pretty much going to watch everything Robert Shaw in, like, I think the next week or two now. I have not seen this movie, but I'm looking it up right now.
Yeah, all these movies throwing out sound. I mean, I got to see this Diamonds thing too. I mean,
yeah, Diamonds for sure.
But Luck of Ginger Coffee has definitely its merits, and it's very good, especially because it was the only film really that Mary Ure, who was at the time Robert Shaw's wife, did together, and they were brilliant in it.
Yeah, Diamonds is gonna be up next.
He's going to have a lot of fun.
Yeah, I this movie looks like it's just amazing.
It's this pretty bad.
I wonder how we can...
Yeah, I know, but you know, sometimes the most amazing movies are bad ones. Nick and I like that very much. I mean, we own the Canon Films box set. Not to say all of them are bad, but I mean, there's some movies in there.
But you know what is funny, just as a little vignette, is that how I end up actually producing... Street Smart is that I originally, Menachem asked me to produce the film which he was going to direct called Over the Top with Sylvester Stallone. So I was already, you know, going with the team scouting location and so on and so forth, when suddenly, when they finally signed Stallone brought his producer, Jimmy Brubaker. I don't know if you know the name.
Yes.
And basically, Jimmy Brubaker and I couldn't function side by side, so I basically step out, and then Menachem said, no, I really like you. Why don't you produce this film with Jerry Schatzberg? So I was so much happier. But it was hysterical, because during the early pre-production, before Stallone actually came aboard, I had to visit all these competition, arm wrestling competition. You guys cannot imagine the collection of guys who are competing there and trying to psych each other. They eating live bugs, they crushing cans in their under teeth or nose. I mean, it was. I don't know if I should laugh or cry, because it was mind-boggling. You know,
I would imagine.
You know, those
so.
Arm wrestlers, those are mainly truck drivers and so on and so forth. And they were quite the characters.
That movie is just a gem from my childhood. I mean, I can't think of a more ridiculous movie than Over the Top. I had to have watched that movie 50 times when I was growing up.
Oh, and the other thing, it was so funny, I had to fly as well to Indiana to a small town called Chipshuana, where they manufactured these cabins which go behind the trucks, you know, where the truckers live. And they were specially building the truck for the film. You know, so it was, I must say, it was quite an experience, but I was happy that I left during pre-production and got a better deal out of it producing Street Smart.
Yeah, I'd say it all worked out.
Yeah, exactly.
For you. All right, so I know our I want to be mindful of our time with you. I really want to segue to talking about City of Industry. Because like I was telling you prior, I have a long history with that film. My buddy who I recently connected with on Facebook, I told him we were going to have you on, and we shared lockers next to one another in middle school, and we would always give each other VHS tapes of whatever movies we got or bought that week. And I remember getting City of Industry and watching it, and that's when I was really into Harvey Keitel. That's when I saw Bad Lieutenant and Reservoir Dogs, and then I started seeing a lot of his back catalog, or as much of it as I could. But City of Industry was a new film, and I remember getting it on VHS and just being completely blown away and mesmerized by it, and I still am to this day, and I just rewatched it a few days ago. That's a film that more people need to see. I think it has accrued quite the cult following, but I don't even know where to begin talking to you about this film. I have so many questions about it. I suppose we should start with the genesis of the film and how you came about producing
it. I've been, you know, because I lived in France and I studied in France, I love the French cinema, and I absolutely adore crime dramas. It's one of my favorite genre, and of course the king of those genre is Jean-Pierre Melville. So I, you know, Circle Rouge and the Alain Delon, the other Alain Delon stuff, I just love his film. And so one day I was at the party and I was introduced to this guy who said, I'm a writer, Ken Solars, and we started to talk. And we both realized that we love this kind of genre, and Jean-Pierre Melville is basically director, writer who we love, and we have a common interest. And he said that, by the way, I wrote this piece called City of Industry, why don't you read it, you know? So I read it, and I really liked it. And at the time, I was already quite a good friend of John Irwin. And I remember we had a breakfast in a valley somewhere in a deli, and then, you know, what you're doing, John, what you're doing, blah, blah, blah. I said, why don't you read this? And he read it, and I knew he would like it. He said, I really like this. He said, by the way, there's this company, Largo Entertainment, which was originally set up by Larry Gordon, but then he was bought out by JVC, the Japanese giant, and at the time it was run by Bar Potter, and he said, they really want me to do something. They gave me this script I don't like. Why don't we go to them with this script? And this was like towards the end of November, and so we went to them. By mid-December, we had the deal memo, and by April 16 or whatever it was, we were shooting the film. Obviously, once we had the deal memo, it was still contingent to get appropriate cast, and it was easier to cast somebody because you had already company behind who can put pay or play offers. And at the time, as you know, Harvey was on the top of his game, and so he was one of our top choices. And so we sent it to Harvey. He kind of quite liked it. But he said he wanted to audition us. So Joe Joan Irvin, myself, and Ken Salazar to fly to New York, meet with the King Harvey, and it went all well. And then once Harvey came on board, everybody wanted to be part of it. You cannot imagine how many actresses wanted to play that part. We had a Mark Wahlberg who came three times to read for the part of Stephen Dorff. And at the end, we decided on Stephen Dorff, for better or worse. But my biggest regret was that the part which Timothy Hutton played, the brother, I brought in, who was already a friend of mine at the time, James Gandolfini, to read. And so he read with Harvey, and Harvey had certain say in the casting, and he did great reading with Harvey. And at the end of the reading, as a part of the reading, he like gave him big hug, etc. And that was over the reading, and I said, Jimmy, I call you later. We're gonna have a drink and dinner at Le Dome, which was still existing on Sunset. And so we were then huddling around and talking with Harvey, and said, I said, you know, guys, I don't know, you know, he's a little bit ham, etc. Anyhow, cut long story short, he persuaded us not to go with him. And I only realized later on is that because he was afraid that Jimmy would actually overpower him. And the other thing was, which was very funny, is that we then had a dinner, Jimmy and I, at Le Dome. We got a little bit drunk. We had steak tartare, etc. The following day, or day 2 days later, I got a call from David Chase, who is friend, and I knew him very well, who was at the time casting The Sopranos. And he called me and said, listen, you know, you casting things, etc., you know, actors. What do you think of Jimmy Gandolfini? I said, David, I just tried to get him on my movie. I couldn't, but read him. You make the decision, but I think he's fantastic because I already knew of what Sopranos was about. And, of course, we know what the result is. I think it was the casting of a lifetime.
I remember you telling me this earlier, and I still can't wrap my mind around it because I remember when I first met you over Facebook, over my City of Industry piece, that thank you, Wayne Kramer, for tagging you in, and that's how we met. I remember saying how much I love the chemistry, or the first of all, the cast, but the chemistry in particular of Harvey Keitel and Timothy Hutton, and how I think they are just perfect together in that film. And I remember you followed up and said how James Gandolfini was originally auditioned for it, and he eventually got nixed. And I can't believe it. I can't imagine what that film would have been with James Gandolfini playing Harvey Keitel's brother.
Well, imagine if it was. That's what you never know, because that's why. Imagine if it was Jimmy Gandolfini playing the brother, Mark Wahlberg playing the runaway cannon. And then instead of Famke Janssen, which actually, that was the only time Largo put a pressure on us, because she just did a Bond film, and they felt that they can have a cachet on foreign markets from her. But we had like, what's her name? James Brolin, ex-wife.
Diane Lane.
Diane Lane, okay. She was my almost top choice. And there were a lot of other actresses. And imagine if it was Diane Lane, Mark Wahlberg, and James Gandolfini and Harvey Keitel. I don't know. It would be probably different film, but would it be worse film? Would it be better film? Would it sell better in the theaters? Who knows?
Yeah, that's what's so fascinating about that, because that alternate cast is amazing, but at the same time, the cast that you had assembled and that's in the film is perfect.
It is perfect, and as well, maybe it was perfect, and maybe John shot it the way he did, streamlined and really no bullshit, because the cast he had, not that they were limited, but because the type of cast, you know, maybe it would have been more expansive if we had the other cast. I don't know. But listen, that's what it is, and I'm happy with the film. I love it. And you know what is funny? If you look at maybe I am, what's the word? Maybe I am overly patting myself on my shoulder, on our shoulder, but that was the first film I recall that has this amazing opening sequence with Massive Attack playing the music. And if you look at since then, not only movies, but even David Chase copied it, all the opening sequences in his Sopranos, and then subsequently other series had these driving sequences with this very cool urban kind of music, you know. So we were actually the first one who did it.
Yeah, I would love to ask you about how you arrived at the choice of director in John Irvin, because I've always felt that he's a super underrated director. His credits include The Dogs of War, which is a great film, Hamburger Hill, which is one of the more underrated Vietnam movies, Raw Deal with Schwarzenegger, which is a blast. And you go through his, you know, Next of Kin. He's a very interesting, eclectic director, a British director. And this is a very American, you know, genre piece, you know, as Frank said in the opening, like the hard nose, the hard bitten noir, the neo noir. And it has some shades of Michael Mann and some shades of Quentin Tarantino. But clearly it's its own thing. How did John Irvin get involved and, you know, what was it like working with him?
Well, as I told you, it's obviously I have seen his films, and I've been already friend with him, you know, through this, I guess, English community here, and etc. And you know, we had dinner parties, etc. And then, as I said, once the script came to my hand, you know, I was thinking, well, who could direct? And then, a few days or week later, I had a breakfast with John, and I remember he was eating his kippers, you know, for breakfast, you know, smoked fish for breakfast. Only Brits and Scots do that. And we were talking, you know, what's his next, and so I said, you know, John, why don't you read this? And he immediately sparks to it, which I kind of knew he would, because he likes this non-nonsensical. As you know, he came from BBC documentaries, and his first big thing was Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the miniseries.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can see that this would have appealed to him, and his style of directing is very much streamlined. You know, it's not overcomplicating things.
Yeah, look no further than something like Hamburger Hill, which is just amazing and so matter of fact about its brutality and violence. I mean, like sort of paving the way for something like Black Hawk Down, you know, years later, where you're really thrown into the shit there. And that movie actually was one of the first Vietnam movies I ever saw as a kid. And it's always stuck with me. And I'm continuously amazed by sort of the lower profile that it has, you know, comparatively speaking to other films. It's ripe for...
Because it wasn't overly dramatized. It was almost done as a documentary. That was the beautiful thing about it, you know.
Ahead of its time in that respect, too. It's due a revisit. I should check it out again.
You should. The film you should check out of John's, actually, was the film, he did it after City of Industry. I can't remember now the title. It was the film that Michael Caine was in it. Michael Caine was playing this American boxing promoter. No, he was playing English boxing promoter, Cockney. And he has his son who he put against this black, big black guy who was a boxing guy. It was in a world of East End boxing. It's one of the most brutal but most brilliant noirish kind of boxing film you have seen. It's so good.
Shiner?
Shiner, exactly.
Oh, my God.
You got to see that
great
film. I love that film.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, Nick, you would love it. Just buy it.
Yeah, I think I've heard of it, actually.
Yeah, it's got great cover art, too.
A great cast, and it really, it works on all levels to me, at least. You know, and again, it was one of those films which was totally overlooked.
Yes. Yes, it is.
You know, unfortunately, you know.
On my list now. Thank you. Yeah, no, and that's sort of what we love. You know, Frank and I love movies that are overlooked and sort of didn't, you know, the ones that sort of got away or escaped without enough, you know, fanfare. It's exciting to find movies like that that have sort of been swept under the rug, and you know, they get a second life.
Absolutely, absolutely, and there are a ton of them out there, you know.
Yes, you know, this is another burning question I wanted to ask you about this. Do you have, or I should say, do you know why that City of Industry hasn't been put out by a boutique label or just gotten a proper Blu-ray release in general? Because I should have mentioned prior for our listeners, but this film's only available on an out-of-print DVD. That's still a reasonable price on Amazon.com. But it just seems very strange to me that somebody like Olive or Twilight Time hasn't put this film out.
I tell you why. Because it's a complicated. It's one of those films which was financed by Largo. Then Largo put P&A and released it through Resurrected Orion. Orion was then bought by MGM. So basically it's an MGM release. So none of these companies... I mean, the original companies who would have had interest, like Largo, to do something and generate more money are no longer in existence and don't own the film anymore, and MGM couldn't care less now. It's not their film, really, as far as they're concerned. They inherited the film. And that's what happened to quite a few films, unfortunately.
Yeah. So it's just sitting on a shelf somewhere.
Exactly. And nobody could care less.
That's very unfortunate.
It is heartbreaking.
Very silly because, you know, Frank and I were chatting, you know, before our chat, and we were talking about how the industry has changed so much over the last, like, I mean, 5 years, let alone 20. And I mean, what, City of Industry is going to be 20 years old next year, which just makes me feel freaking old, but...
Same here.
I mean, if City of Industry got made in the 80s... with the same title, pretty much the same actors, same cast, or an equivalent cast, that movie would come out in the theaters and it would make some coin. In the 90s, as it is, it gets in and out of theaters in a week before it slips off to DVD. And nowadays, it wouldn't even get made as a feature. It would get made as a miniseries or a television.
Video on demand, yeah.
Exactly. Or it would go video on demand 1 week in the theaters and then a Blu-ray, you know, a couple weeks later. And it's so unique to think about how the business model has changed. And you don't get a lot of movies like City of Industry with that sort of quality of actors and the quality of director anymore. Like, now if you're going to get those types of movies, those cop movies, unfortunately, like, you know, they're not going to have as, you know, sort of that as a reputable feel. What do you think about how sort of business has changed, and what is that, you know, like for a movie like City of Industry, like, do you wish that you had made it now?
No, you wouldn't be able to make it. Absolutely, you wouldn't be able to make it now. You know, I don't know what honestly to think anymore about the business. It became, to me, in the 80s, 90s, and even early 2000, it was fun to make movies. But for the last 15 years, I don't know what it is. It's very unpleasant. You meet more unpleasant people. I really don't know. I have been thinking about it because I know I have, you know, two or three films that, and after that, you know, I just don't want to hear about film business, you know. So I don't know, when you look at it, there are either sequels or comic book mega films being done or few animated movies. And in between, everybody else is trying to make whatever it is, you know. I don't know. I really don't know. It's no longer like, as you mentioned, in late 70s when you had Hal Ashby, for example. Look at Hal Ashby's career. He's one of my favorite American directors. I mean, every film was different.
I'll send you a Ebsen, I'll send you an article that I wrote for a website about Hal Ashby. I basically just examined his entire career. I think that he's just one of the most supreme filmmakers. There's nobody like him. There will never be another Hal Ashby. That run that he had in the 70s is just it's celebrated. And yet it's still underrated. Like, you think about just, I mean, Coming Home, Harold and Maude. I'm trying to think of them all.
Last Detail.
Masterpiece, you know?
Yeah, it's just one masterpiece after another. And it really is incredible, you know, that referencing him. And I'll send you that article, though, sort of go off on a little tangent. But I do want to ask, I know we want to be mindful of your time. And we'll certainly, you know, Frank, we jump back into City of Industry. But I just noticed on your credits that you produced or worked on a film called Bat 21,
I was hired to basically line produce it, produce the film, yes.
All right, so when
It was one of the most fun experiences, even though it was very tough, because, you know, at the time, a lot of people were shooting Vietnam movies in Thailand, and we had a budget of $7.2 million, which was written by one sole investor, the guy who started Jack in a Box, because he loved the original book about the Colonel Icefield Hambleton, who was the one who was left behind enemy lines. And so we had to go and make the movie for that. So we decided to go, after scouting location, to go to Malaysia and Borneo. And nobody ever shot film in Borneo.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, again, being that the age that I am, the first three war movies that I saw, you know, at home on HBO, Full Metal Jacket, Hamburger Hill, and Bat 21. And those three movies were playing, you know, throughout that time period. And I can remember seeing them like it was yesterday. I haven't seen Bat 21 in years. Now I have to rewatch. You're putting all these movies. I have to go rewatch all these movies now. That movie, I don't know, Frank, have you seen it? It's
I have not, but I'm going to. Now, this is going to be on my – I'm going to have a busy weekend.
Well, you know, it has a Gene Hackman and Danny Glover, yeah. You know. Gene Hackman is the old colonel whose plane was shot behind enemy lines. And Danny Glover plays the helicopter pilot who decides that he will bring him out, you know.
That's great. There's another movie around that time, Uncommon Valor.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, that one's another good one with Hackman. And, I got to watch Bat 21. Is Bat 21 available on Blu-ray or DVD?
You know, I think it actually has a Blu-ray now, because I recently had a coffee with Peter Markle, the director, and I think he actually supervised the Blu-ray and even put some comments on it. So I'm almost 100% sure it's on a Blu-ray.
I got to check that out. But Diamonds is my priority. That honestly is. I just sent you the poster. The poster is just amazing. Like, I want this framed. I want this poster framed. It's that good.
Yeah. I don't think you even need to smoke a joint to laugh your head off to watch this film. You know?
You'll laugh extra hard, I guess.
Yeah.
To circle back to City of Industry real quick, I wanted to ask you about Elliot Gould, or how the genesis of his casting was, and then, of course, your cameo.
You know, I don't even know now how we came to Elliot. It may have been the idea of Ken Solars, because he somehow met him at the poker game or something. I vaguely remember, because Ken does a little gambling, the writer, and I think he suggested Elliot Gould, and it was such a bizarre idea that we loved it, and I think it worked. It was so against typecasting.
Yeah, I love it, because when I revisited the film, I had forgotten that he was in it. And, I mean, he's got a very small part, but he's very, very good. He's, like, sweaty and cool and kind of sleazy. It's just an added weight to the film that's already heavy in
yeah,
the genre.
Yeah, he plays the bookie who lends money. You know, that's what
right.
it is. Yeah.
Yeah, that he's I love him in it.
Yeah,
all
he
right,
was
so,
very good, very good. And anyhow, and about the Russian guy, I think I mentioned to one of you, or I don't know if I did, is Drutskoy. It was because I do speak Russian, and beside that, Harvey Keitel, as a joke first, insisted that I have to play that part. And I didn't want to play the part necessarily. I had a Russian actor who was in the Moscow on the Hudson who was going to play it, etc. But Harvey insisted, and so I said, okay, why not? So that's there's no other big story behind it. Harvey insisted, so I said, why not? So I played the Russian.
I guess if Harvey Keitel tells you to do something, you do it.
Not only that, but he became quite a buddy and funny guy. Actually, Harvey is, and most actors are like that. I still remember we were shooting one of the scenes out in the countryside, and it was one of those, as directors love to call or DPs, magic hour, right? And it lasts mm-hmm. usually 20 minutes. And Harvey was in his trailer, and director was pulling his hair and screaming and saying, finally, get me the producer. So I run to the set, and he said, I need Harvey here. We're losing light, and said that. So I rushed to the trailer, and there is Harvey. And I said, Harvey, wait. He said, hold on. I'm waiting for my espresso. It's like, he said, Bobby De Niro has to always have an espresso before he has a scene. I have to wait for the espresso, et cetera, and started to, with a smile and this. I said, Harvey, fuck that shit. Please go to the set. I be your waiter. I bring you fucking espresso. We losing light, etc. And you know, when you talk with actors on that level, and they understand that you're not hiding, you're not playing games, he went to the set and shot the scene, you know. It's most of the time we create our own monsters. You know, why actors are difficult? Because agents create them, and then producers are scared, and they create them even more, you know. So rather than playing games, be straight and say, we're doing all the same thing. I'll be your fucking waiter. I'll bring it to you. Just go to the set and shoot. And we got the shot, you know. It's there's no mystery. It's when I honestly, guys, I know I'm not criticizing Americans. I'm American too. But what I find as a European, that somehow when God gave humans common sense, he somewhat missed America a little bit.
Yeah. I don't take,
you know,
any
there's not very much common sense in this country. You see it in politics, you see it, and it simplifies life when you have a common sense.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you just said right there.
We do need to ask you about Surf Ninjas.
Yeah, no, seriously, that is a film that is ingrained.
Okay, so exactly.
In my childhood.
See, there's the separation for like Surf Ninjas would be ingrained in your memory the way that the Masters of the Universe is ingrained.
Exactly.
Surf Ninjas.
Because I'm 5 years younger than you.
But you know what is the funniest thing, which I didn't know? They are now parties of these surfers who used to be kids when the film was out. They are now even a lot of them fathers, and they have a parties where they get stoned, they watch the movies, and they all saying the lines.
This is a party that I need to be at.
I want to go too, because
Abson, you need to give me an invite.
Because Neil Israel, the director, told me about that, you know, and it became absolutely cult classic.
Oh my God.
It was one of the most bizarre films I have ever worked on. It. I mean, imagine, I still have a photograph. Here we are,
in the middle of time.
Sorry?
Yeah. No, who directed Surf Ninjas? Was that John Turteltaub?
No. Neil Israel.
Who did it?
Neil Israel.
Okay, all right.
You know, the guy who was involved in the airplane movies and stuff like that. All those, you know, very crazy, funny movies.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, look at these credits. Jeez. Okay.
Yeah, so, Bachelor Party.
Yep.
You know, he was married to Amy Heckerling for a while, and he was involved in the first Look Who Is Talking, etc. You know, the movie Look Who Is Talking, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
10,000 times watched it.
I mean, and imagine, here we are in Thailand, in Chiang Mai area. We made huge donation to this temple. We bring this whole circus with animals, everybody dressed the local tribe, and suddenly we have a band playing ba 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 ram ba 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 ram, you know, the Beach Boy, but with the words, yeah, like if it was ba ba ram, you know. And there are tourists and monks who suddenly looking at us like we came from a Mars, you know. And it was one of the most bizarre. And then Leslie Nielsen, dressed in that crazy outfit, running up and down these stairs, trying, yes, to pick up the telephone, which he never could because it got into answering machine. So he got so mad he chopped somebody's heads off. I mean, it was one of the most bizarre films I've ever seen. But the funniest thing was that when we had the test screenings for the kids, I have never seen, they went crazy. The kids went crazy. Then somehow they choose the poster, New Line, and this and that. And the film got the worst review. And I remember that I was in somewhere, where was it? In Redondo Beach or whatever. There is a club which Jay Leno used to test his jokes before he goes on a late night show or whatever, tonight show he had. And it was the night he was there, and I was there, etc. And he threw out one line, something like, what is the worst as a kid to say in Hollywood? That your father is out of work? No. That your father produced Surf Ninjas? He didn't know I was in an audience. And, of course, people were laughing, etc. I said, you schmuck. I mean, imagine, out of all people, I am there in the audience, and he said, no, the worst thing is to say that your father produced Surf Ninjas.
And you are a stunt player in that movie, too, according to the Internet Movie Database.
Actually, I was riding motorcycle in that film. It wasn't
Were
for
you
Jean-Claude.
Really?
It wasn't for Jean-Claude. It was, I was one of the gang members.
Wow. And you had dealings with Jean-Claude Van Damme, yet another key piece of my childhood and movie upbringing, between Bloodsport and Kickboxer, Time Cop, Hard Target. Those four movies I watched probably on a loop for there for a while.
But how about Double Impact? That's the one I produced too.
That was
actually, you know, that was the most successful Van Damme movie of all.
Well, Double Impact.
Really?
Well, Double Impact. And Lionheart and Death Warrant, that trio right there too was very big. Double Impact is the one where he's the twins, and that's pretty bad.
We shot it in Hong Kong. Yeah.
What was it like doing like in the early days? Not the early days, but with special effects being what they were. What was it like shooting that movie with two Van Dammes and trying to get it all done the way that you wanted to get it done?
It was, you know, those days you storyboard everything, okay? And then you choose carefully the shots, and then you find two guys. We find actually twin guys who could double for Jean-Claude. So sometimes we use two of them, sometimes we one of them from the side or from the back. And then if you have a Jean-Claude together, then you basically shoot one part with Jean-Claude, the other part against blue screen, and then you put it together in post-production.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it's basically, you just have to, even today, you just have to storyboard everything in details and choose what you do as a practical and what you do as a using visual effects. even though we didn't have CGI, but you had already, obviously, blue screen, green screen, you had, all these elements, you know, opticals, et cetera, you know.
Yes.
It's much easier now. It's absolutely, you know, you shoot it digitally, and you can already do the temp effects while you're editing, you know, so you see more or less how it's going to finish, you know. So it's quite a different process and easier process now.
Surf Ninjas. Everything's flooding back to me about that movie.
Oh, I tell you,
I haven't seen that movie in years.
Rob Schneider, what a bunch. Rob Schneider and Leslie Nielsen and the Mutant Ninja Turtle guy, Ernest Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And his father was as well in a film. Ernest Ray Jr. was the kid. And Ernest Ray Jr. played the mysterious guardian who looks after them. I tell you, what a bizarre movie that was.
I know, I'm going to buy it on DVD.
Just the shoot of it was, I wish somebody did behind the scenes, because it was unbelievable.
And I know we're probably getting close to the end here. I don't know where we're at, Frank, but you also worked as an assistant director, first assistant director. Terror on Tour and Home Sweet Home, those have two of the greatest posters probably ever. I'm gonna have to seek these out.
I tell you, Home Sweet Home. No, To All a Good Night was To All a Good Night is the masterpiece. Because I remember, I had a friend, David Hess. David Hess started as a musician, and he wrote one of the most famous two songs. One was Speedy Gonzales. You remember that song?
Oh, yeah.
La, yes. La, 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 la. You remember that song, right?
Yes.
And the other one is Mon Sugar, which was Elvis Presley, right? Mon Sugar, ha-ha-ha, you know.
Yes.
And he wrote this song, so he was coasting on it. He was actually quite a good musician, but then he decided to be an actor, and unfortunately, he wasn't great as actor, but he was the killer in Last House on the Left, the original one.
Okay.
So if he... And then I met him when I was assistant director and had a part in a film called Avalanche Express, which was, among other people, starring Robert Shaw, Lee Marvin,
yes,
Linda Evans, and so on and so forth. Marg Robson died 3 weeks before the film was finished. Robert Shaw died before we finished, just after we finished the film. So it was one of the best films. But David had a part in it, and my wife and I and he and his wife became friends. Then we reconnected here, and then I was living here like 6 months, and he said, I have this guy who wants to do my movie. It's a horror movie. Everybody does horror movie, etc. I said, okay, let's go there. So here was this one of those sales guys, shady sales guys, and he said, here, I give you $75,000 and you bring me horror movie. And it was about private girls' school, which basically is during the Christmas, and of course the good kids, the parents come and take them home, but the bad kids, who don't have a good parents, even though they're rich, they just have to stay behind, okay? And, of course, suddenly there are two Santa Clauses who are beheading them. That's the brilliant story behind it, right?
This movie sounds amazing.
And the best thing was that Sandy Cope was the sales agent and exec producer on it, who said, but I need a name, I need a name. I said, okay, who you want? I want a Larry Holmes. You know who Larry Holmes was, right? The porno guy, Deep Throat.
John Holmes?
I thought it was Larry Holmes or John Holmes. The one who was in the Deep Throat. He died of AIDS. You know, the famous guy with the long schlong. He was in the
throat. Yeah, that's John Holmes.
Yeah, John Holmes. And he said, I have to have him in. I said, but we're not doing porn. He said, no, he will be the pilot. That is the private jet coming, and he will be beheaded too, and so. So we had John Holmes playing a pilot in the movie as well. I tell you, this film was, that's probably another story, because just this film itself is the funniest story, because we didn't know where to get location. We had $75,000. We find out of all places, you know what Montecito is? Montecito is one of the most expensive real estate near Santa Barbara, probably most expensive in America. It's absolutely exclusive. And we find this empty mansion for sale, like for $15 million. We got it almost for free. It was like three floors. I went to the nearby Catholic school and tell them that we're doing this student film and we don't have the money. Could they lend us mattresses so I can put the crew up, etc.? So they lend us that. So we have a third floor was dormitory for guys. Second floor was for the girls. And ground floor was the set. And the kitchen was the guest house. So I was on it, assistant director, producer, and a cook, because I was cooking for the crew as well. It was, I tell you, the stories from that film are mind-boggling. It's another day, because it would take hours to at least talk about it, but it's one of the most memorable films, and quite a few people kind of made it from that film. It was very funny, but it's a very memorable film.
Well, we've pretty much run out of our time allotment with you. I can't even begin to thank you for coming on our show. And every single story you have told has been mind-blowingly amazing for Nick and myself, and I'm sure our listeners are going to love it as well. I implore you to come back on at some point and tell us all about this film.
I think it's worth it, because I tell you, it's so funny. And I apologize if I was all over the place, maybe, but I just... What we have now is the memories. As long as the memories are good, why not sharing them with people?
Exactly.
Yeah, thank you very, very, very much for coming on and speaking to us. As I said all throughout the chat, like, you're involved with and worked with people that really formed a lot of my, you know, growing up with movies. So this has been a real blast, a real treat. Thank you again. Certainly look forward to another one.
Okay, thank you so much, gentlemen, for your interest.
Absolutely. Talk soon.
Okay, take care. Bye.